I have to admit, when I first picked up the file for today's deep dive, I almost put it back down.
Oh, yeah.
I saw the title, Macro Segregation in Steel Ingots, and I thought, okay, surely there's a limit to how niche we can get. It sounds, you know, like the kind of thing you'd read if you were having trouble sleeping.
It does have a certain dryness to the title, doesn't it? It sounds like pure academic metallurgy.
Exactly. But then I started reading the introduction, and I realized my initial reaction was completely wrong. We aren't just talking about chemistry in a beaker here.
No.
We are talking about arguably the highest stakes manufacturing on the planet. We're talking about the safety of nuclear reactors.
That is the pivot point. It starts with microscopic crystal growth, but it ends with, you know, 200-ton pressure vessels that have to contain nuclear reactions for 60 years.
And that's the part that just blew my mind. The scale.
The sheer scale of it.
Yeah. We're looking at a thesis by Edward John Pickering from Cambridge, and he's studying these steel ingots that are the size of a small house. And the central thesis is basically, how do we make sure this giant block of metal doesn't have a secret, invisible flaw inside it that could cause a catastrophe?
And that really is the mission of this deep dive, to understand how you even make something that big, why the laws of physics seem, well, hell-bent on ruining it, and the surprisingly clever ways engineers fight back.
Because it's not a solved problem.
No, because, as it turns out, making a perfect piece of steel that size is technically impossible.
Impossible.
So practically impossible to get it perfectly homogeneous. You are always, always managing imperfections.
Well, that's comforting. Let's start with the core concept here, macro segregation. I know what segregation means in a social context, keeping groups apart, but in a block of steel, what is separating from what?
Okay, so think about baking a cake. You mix your flour, sugar, eggs, cocoa powder, right?
Right.
You whip it all up into a batter. Right. When you pour it into the pan, it's a homogeneous mixture. Every spoonful has the same amount of sugar and cocoa.
Right. Hopefully.
Hopefully. Now imagine you put that cake in the oven, and as it bakes, the sugar decides it doesn't want to be near the flour anymore. It separates. It migrates.
So when you slice it.
When you slice the cake, one slice is pure flour and another slice is a rock-hard lump of caramelized sugar.
That would be a terrible cake.
That is essentially macro segregation. We tend to think of steel as this uniform gray metal, but it's a cocktail.
An alloy.
It's an alloy. It's mostly iron, but it has carbon, silicon, manganese, sulfur, phosphorus, a whole list of things. When it's liquid, they're all mixed happily. But the moment you start to freeze it, to turn it from liquid to solid, that mixture wants to separate.
Why? Does the iron just kick the other ingredients out?
That is almost literally what happens. It's a phenomenon called solute rejection. Imagine you're freezing a bucket of salt water. The ice that forms first wants to be pure water. The crystal structure of ice is very exclusive. It doesn't really have room for salt atoms. So as the ice crystal grows, it pushes the salt away into the remaining liquid.
So the water turns to ice, and the leftover liquid gets saltier and saltier.
Exactly. Now apply that to steel. As the molten metal cools, it forms these solid crystals. We call them dendrites because they look like little pine trees.
Dendrites, right.
And these dendrites are pure iron. They reject the carbon, the sulfur, all the other alloying elements back into the liquid pool around them.
Okay, I get the mechanism. But why is this a macro problem? If this is happening on a microscopic level between these tiny crystal trees, wouldn't the segregation just be tiny? You know, like microscopic spots of carbon?
That's a great question. And if it stayed right there, trapped between the branches of the trees, we would call it microsegregation.
And that's okay.
That's actually fixable. You can heat the steel up later, and the atoms will sort of wiggle around and spread out evenly. It's like letting a teabag steep. Eventually, it balances out.
But we're talking about macrosegregation.
Right. This is when that enriched solute heavy liquid doesn't just sit there. It moves. It flows. It creates currents.
Oh.
Imagine if all that salty water in your bucket started flowing to the top. Now you have a bucket where the bottom is fresh ice and the top is a layer of brine. That separation is on the scale of centimeters or even meters.
And you can't fix that by just heating it up.
No way. The distances are just too great for the atoms to diffuse. Once macrosegregation happens, those chemical differences are locked in forever. You have parts of your steel that are chemically different from the rest.
And I'm guessing these different parts aren't just cosmetic. They have different properties.
Drastically different, and usually worse. They are often harder, but much more brittle. And that brings us to the main villain of Pickering's thesis, the A segregate.
The A segregate sounds like a bad grade.
In a way, it is. It's the defect that keeps metallurgists awake at night. To understand how it forms, We have to go into the mushy zone.
I love that term, the mushy zone. It sounds so unscientific for something involved in nuclear engineering.
It is the technical term. It refers to that transition state. The steel isn't liquid, but it's not solid yet.
It's a slush.
It's a thick, slushy forest of those dendrite trees growing into the liquid. Now, remember we said the growing crystals reject elements like carbon and silicon into the liquid.
Right, the dirty liquid.
So here is where the physics gets a little counterintuitive.
Yeah.
Usually, if you add more stuff to a liquid, like adding sugar to tea, it gets heavier. It sinks.
Sure. Density increases.
But in steel, specifically with carbon and silicon, the opposite happens. When the liquid gets enriched with these elements, it actually becomes less dense.
Wait, really?
It gets lighter than the surrounding metal.
So the liquid full of impurities wants to float.
It creates buoyancy. So deep inside this mushy zone, deep inside the wall of the ingot, you have these pockets of enriched liquid that start to rise. It's like bubbles in champagne, but much, much slower.
And as it rises,
this liquid flows upward. And
yeah.
Because it's chemically different and it's flowing, it actually delays the freezing of the steel around it. It creates a channel.
A chimney.
Exactly. They call it the chimney effect. This rising plume of liquid carves out a vertical tunnel through the mushy zone. Eventually, the whole block freezes and that tunnel freezes too. But now you're left with a pencil-thin, rope-like streak of material that is totally different from the steel around it, that is an A-segregate.
So you've got these vertical ropes of brittle, carbon-rich steel hidden inside the walls of the ingot.
Yes. And they're usually found in the mid-radius, not at the surface, not at the center, but halfway in, just lurking there.
And why is that specific rope of steel so dangerous?
Because of how it breaks. The thesis discusses these things called Charpy V-notch tests.
That's the impact test, right? Where they hit it with a big hammer?
A massive pendulum hammer, yeah. You take a sample of steel, cut a notch in it, and you see how much energy the steel absorbs before it snaps. Good steel for a reactor should be tough. It should absorb a lot of energy, maybe bend or tear before breaking.
And the A segregates.
They don't bend, they snap. It's called intergranular brittle failure. The crack just runs right along the grain boundaries.
So if you have these channels in a pressure vessel,
and that vessel is under immense pressure or, say, a thermal shock, that A segregate becomes a fuse. It's a pre-made crack. Just waiting to happen.
That is a terrifying image. We're talking about a vessel holding radioactive material under high pressure. You really don't want pre-made cracks in the walls.
You really don't.
So if this is all caused by the physics of freezing, can't we just freeze it faster or differently? I think to understand that, we need to visualize the sheer scale of this manufacturing process. The thesis uses Sheffield Forge Masters as a case study. We mentioned 200 tons earlier.
It's hard to convey just how big that is. 200 tons is like stapping 100 large SUVs into a single block.
Uh-oh.
It's a blue whale, a massive amount of energy and mass.
So walk us through it. They don't just melt this in a pot on a stove.
No. It starts with an electric arc furnace melting scrap steel. But you can't just pour that into a mold. The first major step for quality is something called vacuum stream degassing.
That sounds intense. What are they degassing?
They pour the molten steel through a chamber that's under a vacuum. As the stream of metal falls, the vacuum literally sucks out the gases dissolved in the liquid, specifically hydrogen, oxygen, and nitrogen.
Why? What happens if you leave them in?
Well, if you leave hydrogen in, you get hydrogen cracking or flaking. The gas builds up pressure inside the solid metal and cracks it from the inside.
Wow.
And oxygen causes oxides, basically dirt inclusions in the steel. You need this metal to be incredibly clean before it even touches the mold.
Okay, so the metal is clean. Now they pour it.
They do bottom pouring. They don't pour from the top like you'd pour water into a glass. That would cause splashing, turbulence, mix air back in.
We want it to be smooth.
Exactly. They inject the steel into the bottom of the mold so it rises up gently, like filling a bathtub from the drain.
Smooth and steady.
But once that mold is full, now the waiting begins. And this is the root of the problem. A 200-ton ingot doesn't freeze in minutes. It takes days.
Days?
It could take 2 or 3 days for the center of that block to turn solid. It's just sitting there, radiating heat. And that long time frame is exactly what gives the A-segregates time to form. Those buoyant currents have 40, 50 hours to flow and carve out their chimneys.
It's a slow-motion disaster.
Precisely. If we could freeze it instantly, like in a sci-fi movie, the segregation wouldn't happen. The atoms would be trapped in place. But because we are limited by thermodynamics, you can only pull heat out so fast, the chemistry have time to wreak havoc.
And the thesis mentions that A-segregates aren't the only defects. There's a whole zoo of defects.
There really is. You have the A-segregates in the walls. Then you look at the very center of the ingot, the core. This is the last part to freeze.
Okay.
And as it solidifies, it's this mushy, collapsing network. Gravity is pulling it down. Shrinkage is pulling it apart. It literally tears itself open.
So you get cracks right down the middle.
Yes. Fissures.
I see.
And those fissures fill with that enriched liquid we talked about. These form V-segregates. They look like stacks of V-shapes running down the center line.
Okay, so V-shapes in the center, ropey A-shapes in the walls. What about the bottom?
The bottom gets something called negative base segregation. We sometimes call it the cone of purity.
The cone of purity sounds like a good thing?
You'd think so. Remember the dendrite crystals, the trees?
Yeah.
Sometimes branches break off.
Mm-hmm.
Or crystals form freely in the liquid. Since these are solid and pure, they're actually denser than the liquid.
Ah, so while the dirty liquid floats up, the clean crystals sink down.
Exactly. They snow down to the bottom of the mold and pile up. So you end up with a cone at the base that is too pure. It lacks the alloying elements, the carbon, the manganese, that give the steel its strength. So the bottom is too soft.
This sounds like a nightmare. The bottom is too soft. The center is cracked. And the walls are full of brittle chimneys. How on earth do they make a usable pressure vessel out of this?
That brings us to the battle tactics. How do we solve this? You might assume it's the 21st century, let's just run a computer simulation to find the perfect cooling settings.
That seems like the logical first step.
But the thesis highlights what it calls the computational nightmare.
Why is it a nightmare? We simulate black holes. We simulate weather systems.
It's a problem of multi-scale physics. You have to simulate fluid flow, heat transfer, and chemical diffusion.
Right.
And you have to do this on a millimeter scale because the channels are tiny, but for an object that is 3 meters wide.
So the sheer number of data points is too high.
It's massive. The thesis mentions a prediction from a researcher named Beckerman in 2000. He thought we'd have solved this by 2010. But in 2014, when this thesis was written, a full simulation for just one large ingot would still take weeks or even months to run on a cluster.
And if you're a manufacturer, you can't wait a month just to see if your settings are okay.
Exactly. You have a delivery schedule. So instead of brute force simulation, Pickering's thesis focuses on a kind of hack, a simpler tool called the Rayleigh criterion.
I saw this in the notes, the Rayleigh number. This is the hero of the story.
He is the hero of the math, at least. The Rayleigh number is a dimensionless ratio. Think of it as a scoreboard for a tug of war between two forces.
Okay, who are the teams?
On one side, you have the buoyancy forces. That's the lighter, enriched liquid trying to float up and form a chimney. They're the bad guys.
And the good guys.
The retarding forces. This is the friction of the mushy zone, the forest of crystals. If the forest is thick enough and tight enough, it blocks the flow. It holds the liquid in place.
So the Rayleigh number just tells you who is winning.
Effectively, it calculates the ratio. If the number stays below a certain critical value, it means the friction is winning. The liquid can't move fast enough to form a channel. No A-segregates.
That seems incredibly useful. Instead of a month-long simulation, you just calculate one number.
That's the beauty of it. It allows an engineer to say, what if we add a bit more silicon? They run the calc. Oh, that spikes the Rayleigh number because it makes the liquid lighter? Bad idea. It gives them a quick way to predict safety without a supercomputer.
But predicting it is one thing. Actually fixing the giant block of metal sitting on the factory floor is another. You still have a 200-ton ingot with a soft bottom and a cracked center.
Right. The casting is just act one. Act two is the forging. And this is where we leave the delicate physics and get into what I call brute force remediation.
I have to say, the terminology here is delightful. Saddening, upsetting, and becking. It sounds like emotional states, not manufacturing processes.
It really does. I'm going to go sadden this ingot. But the reality is incredibly violent. These are massive hydraulic presses. Saddening is just a light squash to flatten the ridges on the outside of the ink.
And upsetting.
That's the big move. They take this massive, glowing hot cylinder, remember it's 200 tons, stand it up on its end, and crush it vertically. They squash it down until it's half its original height.
Why?
It turns into a fat barrel. And it's all about healing. That massive compression forces the porosity, the tiny holes, to close up. It welds them shut, and it breaks up those big crystal dendrites, crushing them into a finer grain structure, which makes the steel tougher.
Okay, so that fixes the structure. But what about the V segregates? Those cracks and chemical messes right in the center, you can't squash a chemical difference away.
You can't. And this is my favorite solution in the whole process because it is so simple. It's called hollow punching.
Let me guess. They just remove it.
They literally drive a massive steel punch right through the center of the barrel.
Oh, yeah.
They treat the core like an apple core. They punch it out and throw it away.
So the V segregates, the cracks, that nasty stuff in the middle, it's just gone.
Gone. And since you're making a pressure vessel, which is essentially a giant ring or pipe, you need it to be hollow anyway. So by punching at the core, you remove the worst defects and shape the part at the same time.
That is elegant. Problem solved.
Well, solved for the center. But remember where the A segregates are.
Ah, you said they were in the mid-radius?
Exactly. They are further out. When you punch out the center, the A segregates are still there. They are trapped in the wall of the remaining ring.
And you can't punch them out because that's the metal you need.
And you can't heat treat them away because they are macrofegregation.
So that brings us right back to the beginning. You have to prevent A segregates from forming in the first place.
Yes. They are the stubborn survivors. If you let them form during that 3-day cooling period, they survive the forging, they survive the punching, and they end up in the reactor wall. That is why Pickering's work on the Rayleigh criterion is so vital. You have to win the battle in the mushy zone, or you lose the war.
And looking forward, the thesis suggests this battle is getting harder, not easier. It compares the current steel, SA 508 grade 3, with a new contender, grade 4N. Why do we want new steel?
We always want better performance. Grade 3 is the workhorse. It's what most current reactors are made of. But grade 4N has more nickel and chromium. It is significantly stronger and tougher.
Okay.
That means you could build larger reactors or run them in higher pressures, which makes them more efficient.
So it sounds like a no-brainer. Upgrade to grade 4N.
But there is a trade-off. Remember the Rayleigh number? It depends on density.
And adding nickel changes the density.
Precisely. The thesis investigates whether this new super steel is more prone to segregation. It turns out when you add that nickel, you change the flow characteristics of the liquid. You might make the steel stronger on paper, but if that chemistry makes the liquid more buoyant, you might create more A segregates.
So you could end up with a material that is theoretically stronger but practically weaker because it's full of these brittle chimneys.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's a perfect example of why you can't just design materials in a lab. You have to consider the manufacturing history. How does it freeze? How does it flow? A stronger alloy is useless if you can't cast a sound ingot out of it.
It really feels like we are balancing on a knife edge here. We have these incredible high-tech ambitions, but we're limited by how a bucket of liquid freezes. We use supercomputers, but rely on a simple ratio. We have advanced metallurgy, but we solve the centerline defect by just punching the middle out like a donut.
It is a fascinating mix of high science and brute force industrialism. And I think that's what makes this thesis stand out. It wasn't done in an ivory tower. It was collaboration with Rolls-Royce and Sheffield Forge Masters. It's science getting its hands dirty on the factory floor, trying to solve a real-world problem.
It definitely changes how I look at the material world. We tend to think of steel as this solid, unchanging, monolithic thing. Strong as steel, right?
Right. But this deep dive reveals that steel is actually a frozen snapshot of a chaotic battle. It's a record of liquid flowing, crystals growing, elements rejecting each other, gravity pulling things down, buoyancy pushing things up.
Wow.
The steel in a nuclear reactor isn't just a material. It's a history of that event.
And the scars of that bottle, the A segregates, are what determine if the reactor keeps us safe.
Precisely.
It leaves me with a thought. We are building these massive structures, pushing the limits of engineering. But at the end of the day, we are at the mercy of thermodynamics. It makes me wonder, is it actually possible to ever create a truly perfect large ingot? Or are we just getting better and better at managing the chaos?
That is the ultimate question. As we push for larger components and new alloys, the chaos changes. We might suppress the A segregates, but maybe something else pops up. It's a continuous game of cat and mouse with the laws of physics.
Managing the chaos. I like that. We'll leave you with that thought. Next time you look at a massive steel structure, remember the invisible chimneys hiding inside.
Thanks for listening to The Deep Dive.